Hi, and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Robert Bound. This is the show that looks behind the headlines, talking to the correspondents who bring the stories to the front pages. Ahead on the programme, we hear from Latvian's Prime Minister about his country's depopulation. We find out what Japan's doing in the south of Sudan, and we talk to the new editor-in-chief of the Columbian Review of Journalism about how to keep an august journal afloat and fresh. All that coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But first, the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Lucas Papademos, a former deputy head of the European Central Bank, is tipped to emerge as Greek prime minister as political leaders bargain over who will lead a new coalition to push through a bailout before the country runs out of money in mid-December. The current prime minister, George Papandreou, has agreed to step down as the new coalition government approves the multi-billion euro bailout. They'll then have to explain to the EU how they'll use the emergency funding of 130 billion euros. Earlier, a government spokesman, Elias Mosialos, had this to say.
It's a historical day for Greece. We will have a coalition government very soon, early next week. The Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition will discuss tomorrow the name of the next Prime Minister and the names of the ministers.
On the streets of Athens, there's been a sceptical reaction to the news of a coalition.
Whatever happens, it's a vicious circle. It's too late.
I do feel positive. Because the country has to be represented in a unanimous way.
Then you miss.
I'm not optimistic. If we don't change our way of thinking, I'm not optimistic.
The Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi defied huge pressure to resign today, desperately playing his last cards to see off a party revolt as fears over Italy's instability hit markets across Europe. Berlusconi denied reports by journalists close to him that he would resign within hours, immediately reversing a brief recovery in stock and government bond markets battered by political uncertainty in the Eurozone's third economy. A new Syrian opposition group backed by Bashar al-Assad's former vice president, Abdel Halim al-Khaddam, said today it wanted to unify the various opposition strands and use, quote, all means necessary to oust the Syrian leader. The National Committee to Support the Syrian Revolution was unveiled in Paris today with 65 founding members, including lawyers, businessmen and doctors, as well as Khaddam, who served Assad and his father Hafez al-Assad for nearly 30 years. Liberian police stormed the headquarters of presidential challenger Winston Tubman today before being repelled by United Nations peacekeepers, who've set up a cordon around the building. Liberian police fired tear gas and some live rounds as they entered the compound, but were pushed back by Nigerian UN peacekeepers who were positioned there. Europe's largest budget airline, Ryanair, has posted a 20% increase in half-year profits of more than £467 million. But it says passenger numbers will fall by 10% this month as it grounds 80 planes this winter because of high fuel prices. Ryanair's chief executive is Michael O'Leary.
People are still flying during the recession, they're still going on holidays, they're still flying to meet friends and family, but they're becoming more and more price sensitive. So in a recession, Ryanair is doing very well.
A US judge sided with tobacco companies today, granting a temporary injunction blocking rules requiring new warning labels that use graphic images like a man exhaling cigarette smoke through a hole in his throat. US District Judge Richard Leon granted a temporary injunction after determining that the tobacco companies would likely prevail in their lawsuit challenging the Food and Drug Administration's requirement as unconstitutional because it compels speech in violation of the First Amendment. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, the haircutted Nick Kelly. By the way, I always like to leave an almost unprofessionally long pause before announcing the news, as you noticed there.
Yes, it sort of adds to the drama.
Almost, but not quite unprofessional. I'll do no such thing before we introduce Thomas Schaffernacker with the global weather.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
It's been quite a weekend on the weather front across southern Europe. I'm referring to the terrible flash floods, of course, in Italy and France. And the forecast is not looking too optimistic. Unfortunately, more rain to come across the western Mediterranean regions, and further flooding is possible, perhaps even in the same areas that have already been flooded. And we may have to wait until the end of the week before the heavy rainstorms stop completely. Most of the continent, however, will be dry and quite mild. But later on Tuesday, we will have our first winter storm in Europe. However, it'll be affecting Western Russia and Moscow will turn much colder. It'll snow here a bit too. So here's the business center forecast then for tomorrow for Tuesday. Moscow, quite cold. Temperatures on Tuesday only +2 degrees, sleet and snow by evening. In Berlin, mild, 12 degrees the high and quite sunny. Paris and London, both overcast and damp at times. The temperatures here around 12 or 13 degrees. And quickly on air travel, the weather at many major airports looks good into Tuesday across Europe. Fine at Frankfurt, Heathrow, Berlin. But if you're flying to and from Moscow, because of the possibility of this snow, there is that risk of a few delays, but it shouldn't really be too bad, of course. It is Russia after all. Okay, into North America now, and currently we have a snowstorm across central parts of Canada affecting Manitoba, Ontario. Quebec will also be getting some snow. Meanwhile, across the border in the United States, severe storms are also brewing across the southern and central states, from say Texas to Oklahoma. Thunderstorms here, maybe even a few isolated tornadoes. At the same time, heavy rain further north in Chicago and Milwaukee, and snow over the Rockies. So lots of heavy weather in the central portion of the United States. The Atlantic seaboard, however, so New York City and DC, will have good weather through Monday into Tuesday. In fact, all the way from Florida through Georgia up to New York State and into New England. So on to the city forecast then for Monday and into Tuesday. Toronto and Chicago, both sunny on Monday. Rain on Tuesday, around 15 degrees here, the high. New York City, sunny and warm, 18, so quite warm. Los Angeles, also around 18 and sunny. In Miami in the tropics, mostly sunny and highs of 27 degrees. And then air travel, good weather along the eastern seaboard. That includes Atlanta Airport, for example. But more stormy and turbulent conditions for flying across the central part of the US. So Oklahoma, Kansas, those areas, big cumulonimbus clouds here. So the bad guys, essentially. Let's head east now and take a look at Hong Kong on Tuesday. The story is a wet one, thunderstorms expected. In fact, many parts of southern China will have heavy rain. And some flooding is expected in Guangdong and Fujian provinces, Vietnam getting the heavy rains too, and also in Taiwan. But meanwhile, in Japan, it's much better. Tokyo sunshine and 18 degrees. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas Schaffernacker. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time's approaching 9 minutes plus 1800 hours, which means night-night Asia. It means good afternoon, New York City. In a moment, we'll be hearing from the Prime Minister of Latvia about problems for a nation losing its population.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Es ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle
24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome to Midori House, back on the echoey sounding Monocle 24. Now, in 2009, Latvia introduced a strict austerity programme, the results of which are causing the population to leave in droves. 40,000 people have left Latvia every year since 2008. Earlier today, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, spoke to the country's Prime Minister, Valdis Dombrovskis, about what a small country like Latvia can do to keep its population. And he started by asking him what was the cause of the mass exodus.
I think it's linked with two main factors. We saw it already in 2004-2005, just as Latvia joined the EU, with tens of thousands of Latvians leaving for old EU member states for jobs. And different kind of researches were done, and not surprising, the conclusion was that fundamentally it's basically wage difference between Latvia and many old member states and job opportunities. And then during 2006-2007 we saw that this process was slowing down, even to the extent reverting, with wage growth, with job opportunities, people were much less inclined to leave the country. and again with a crisis starting from 2009, we have this problem again. And the two reasons are still the same. It's wage difference and job opportunities.
And where is everyone going?
Well, it depends. In 2004-2005, it was mainly UK and Ireland, because only three old member states opened their labor markets. It was UK, Ireland and Sweden. But less people went to Sweden, apparently because of a language barrier. Now labor market is opened in all EU member states, so people are going all over the place.
And what does this say about your country when, you know, so many people just want to leave?
Well, it says exactly this, that we should be working very hard on our economic development, because really it is a huge problem. And fundamentally, if we want people to stay, we need economic development, we need job opportunities, we need well-paid jobs.
Well then, does that suggest that the austerity measures that your government has brought in have failed then, if the economy still isn't at the levels it was before the crisis, and if so many people have left the country?
Well, with these austerity measures, there, I would say, already in late 2008, when Latvia applied for this international loan program with IMF and European Commission, by that time it was already too late, because then there were no good options on the table anymore. Then there were only bad options: to devaluate the currency, to do austerity without devaluating the currency, which each scenario has its different effects. But if Latvia as a country was following some irresponsible macroeconomic policy during the boom years, without balancing the budget, even though we had double-digit economic growth, with credit amounts increasing in a matter of couple of years four times in economy, with current account deficit more than 20% of GDP, then once global financial crisis started, well, Latvia's economy went into deep trouble. By that time, there is already no good options. There was just choice of bad options, and really then it was important to the extent, if you want, front-load this adjustment, to go through this stage of financial stabilization. And we expect to close or to finish this international loan program December 22nd this year.
But it's still not really working, though, is it? I mean, you can say that, you know, you hope to finish this loan program, that you hope that there'll be improvements, but the fact remains that your GDP is still a far lower level than it was before the crisis. And yeah, as we've been talking about during this interview, 10% of your population has left.
As regards GDP, again, most of this GDP growth before crisis, unfortunately, was a bubble. It was overheated economy, it was a real estate bubble, it was construction boom. And yes, we certainly do not have this real estate bubble and construction boom anymore. But if you look, for example, at industrial production indicators, at export indicators, those are already starting to exceed pre-crisis levels. So we really came back to economic growth. We expect at least 4.5% growth this year. And we also are changing the structure of economy to one which is more sustainable, with more emphasis on industrial production and exports, to sectors which are also, by the way, creating many jobs, instead of emphasis on real estate bubble.
Prime Minister, may I ask you a personal question? Have any of your friends or family left the country in the past few years?
Well, yes. You basically see that it's true that you hear from the people that some are leaving, or somebody's children are leaving, or so. That's unfortunately the case when we have this substantial emigration, you tend to hear it.
And for yourself, I mean, when you finish your term as Prime Minister, do you see yourself remaining in Latvia, or do you think you might one day join the exodus too?
Well, I had been outside of Latvia already for several times. I had been studying in Germany, had been studying in the US, but nevertheless I have returned to Latvia, so I would rather expect to stay in Latvia, or at least be closely linked with it.
So you've done your time abroad then?
I would say so.
Okay. And let's talk about what the positives that you can take out of this. When you have, you know, less people in your country, when you know, do you think that means there's opportunities because you've got a bit more space? Are there more opportunities for the people that stay?
Unfortunately, no. It's not that we lack space. We are a relatively scarcely populated country, so space is not an issue in Latvia. It's rather really, since we have this problem, that it's mainly young or middle-aged people which are leaving. It only worsens our demographic situation, and it worsens also age proportions, making share of pensioners vis-a-vis share of working population higher. And that also has implications for long-term stability of social budget. So definitely with this immigration, there are much more problems than, if any, benefits.
Okay, and just finally, what is the way out of this? How do you bring people back, encourage, you know, both Latvians to return to Latvia and maybe encourage new people to come to your country?
Well, again, there are one fundamental way how to achieve it. It's through economic development, through job creation, and through convergence with the rest of the EU. Because if we are not to converge with the rest of the EU, those problems will persist. People will find that they can find higher salaries somewhere else, or there are better job opportunities, or this and that, and they will be leaving. So a fundamental question here is economic development and convergence with the rest of the EU.
That was our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, talking to the Latvian Prime Minister, Valdis Dombrovskis, who I think we should really play Ghost Town by the Specials outside of that. But actually, we're going to be speaking to the new editor-in-chief of the Columbia Journalism Review and see what she's got in her new in-tray on her new desk after this.
You can now listen to Monocle 24 as it was engineered to be heard on a radio. Monocle's design team has been working with the talented people at Revo Technologies in Scotland to develop a special edition of their Heritage G2 radio. It's capable of streaming in thousands of web-based radio stations. The Revo Heritage also pulls in FM, DAB, and can dock iPods and iPhones. With its elegant aluminium and walnut finish, the Special Edition Heritage's best feature is an M24 button that will take you direct to our live stream. You can buy your Monocle 24 Revo Heritage at shop.monocle.com. or through our stores in London, New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo and Osaka. The Monocle Revo Heritage G2 for easy, elegant listening.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and Shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the Peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on M24 with me, Robert Bound. Now on the line we have Cindy Stivers, who's just been appointed Editor-in-Chief of the Columbia Journalism Review, the bi-monthly magazine published by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism since 1961, is a piece of print that's seen by many as a sort of touchstone for the news behind the news. And on the eve of her taking up her new post, we want to get a sense of what still inspires her about the Columbia Journalism Review. Cindy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
I think first up, I wanted to ask you that exact question. What still inspires you, and do you hope to inspire in others with the Columbia Journalism Review?
thanks for starting with a small question.
I'd like a 10-point program, please.
I really feel like it is a very exciting time because, really, the need to know what's going on and sift through all the many voices and the hype and the cant and everything else is more necessary than ever. And, you know, I really believe that editors are the ones who help you do that. And no matter who you are, even if you want to participate in the news reporting and gathering, as, you know, our audience now does, you still need, you know, some people who are willing to devote the time to sifting and trying their best to make sense of it all. So I think that, you know, that the fact that our craft is evolving that way, the technology is evolving to allow us to do it in new and exciting ways, and bringing the audience into the conversation, I actually think it's really thrilling. So.
And I said in the introduction that the CJR has been kind of bringing people the news behind the news and about news gathering itself, and, you know, stories about the media and how it works since its inception. Is that job? Do you think that job's got easier or harder since the sort of dawn of internet publishing and the aggregation of news?
Oh, I think much more challenging because, you know, you can't really sit up on, you know, some journalistic pedestal and wag fingers at people anymore, you know, if you ever really could. You know, I just don't think that people want that. That's not terribly helpful. And everything moves too quickly to really just do that. I think it's all much more fungible than it was. It's, you know, things... It's going to be fascinating to see what we end up feeling will hold for a bimonthly print magazine, in addition, and how we parse what we do on the daily website much more. Mm-hmm. You know, it's I haven't, as you mentioned, I haven't started yet, so so I guess I'll find out soon enough. But
and I wanted to ask you that. I mean, you know, what is it, have you been brought into? You know, is it about getting clicks on your website? Is the job of the journalism review itself sort of changing as the media changes? I mean, obviously there's a lot of soup, there's a lot of word soup all around you. And you obviously have to adapt to change to sit in that and be relevant as well. You can't just be, or maybe you can be, a big chunk of paper that comes out every 2 months.
No, I think you're right. I think the main thing is that it does still need to be, you know, kind of a serious assessment of, you know, of how we are all doing our job, but absolutely it has to be much more nimble than what you just described.
Yeah.
Or we won't be very successful. No, I really do feel that it has to be, you know, we will be making it, in that sense, making it up as we go along, as the media is doing now, right? I mean, it's all changing so quickly, and, you know, our standards of fairness and, you know, what's right and wrong, I think, should be intact, as it has been for 50 years.
Intact's good. Intact's a good starting point. Intact.
But it's definitely going to be, you know, interesting how we define, you know, how often we do certain features and, you know, who we count upon. And, I mean, certainly the idea of the... you know, kind of capturing the there's a really amazing conversation going on even in the halls of the journalism school and in many journalism schools and in every newsroom that I know of about how are we doing what we do, how can we do it better, how can we do it faster, smarter, cheaper, all of that.
And I wonder what lessons you brought with you. You were just editor-in-chief of EW.com, the Entertainment Weekly website, and before that, Time Out New York. These are jobs that, on the face of it, seem very different, at least in reputation, to being editor-in-chief of the Columbia Journalism Review, which sounds a little bit more stern than Entertainment Weekly. Is there a sense... Sorry?
Just a tad.
Is part of your appointment in order to sort of excite some revenue potential and clicks and refresh the title, especially online?
Well, I wouldn't, you know, I would say that certainly, yeah, if you just look it on the face of it, I no longer need to worry about who's being kicked off, you know, Dancing with the Stars this week, which is actually something of a relief.
I thought there was not enough of that in the CJR, actually, the last time I looked.
I don't really think that's going to become a major feature. But, I mean, it is a nonprofit. It is part of an academic institution, so It isn't like I have to go out and, you know, and double our audience, as we happily were able to do with Entertainment Weekly. At the same time, though, it does need to be right in the middle of the conversation. I feel that it should be right at the tip of everyone's tongue when they're thinking, you know, how do we think about this strange evolution that we're in the middle of, and how do we, what is the best tool for, you know, I really think we can get a lot more practical, and I also think that in times of, you know, massive change and confusion, you know, it won't kill you to have a little wry humor along the way.
No, indeed. Well, I think that's the thing. And do you feel that the Journalism Review has got a little bit of a po-faced reputation? Do you think if people actually look between the covers, they'd find something a little bit more amusing, a little bit more fresh and wry, as you say?
Well, I do think that, you know, the people who work there are, you know, people who are already there are good and know what they're doing. And I think it is all down to how, you know, any particular editor, you know, figures what is the right mix of things to go between covers and then on a website and all the rest of it. I think the main thing I can bring is that I've had to, you know, kind of do a lot with little resources, meaning money, not a lot of programming help, things like that. You know, so I feel that on that level I have, I'm used to having to make do and, you know, come up with, get a team working in a way that is, you know, it's fun to do. I really actually believe that. I still feel that we are unbelievably fortunate and privileged to get to be kind of nosy, poke around, figure out what's going on, ask people for their stories, and tell people about it and get paid for it. It just seems like a scam to me still.
It sounds so good. It sounds all right. Cindy Stivers on the line from New York, thank you very much for joining us. We're looking forward to the first cover of the Columbia Journalism Review with the Kim Kardashian grossometer on it, obviously, of course. Mixing the best of both worlds. Cindy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for the suggestion.
Thanks. I'll take a consultancy fee.
Sure.
We're going to stay in New York now. You're with me on Monocle 24. We're going to have the Beachy Boys.
Microphone's wrecked. Wine's been drunk and heads been checked. I see one last profiter rolling in my play. Pass a microphone to MCA.
No stop on the top and you clock and we rock. Never picking, never sticking. We've been making hip hop. Come on, everybody.
That was the Beastie Boys, not the Beach Boys. wrong side of the United States. It's approaching the bottom of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll be finding out why Japan is investing in sending ground self-defense forces to southern Sudan. But first, the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Rob. Lucas Papademos, a former deputy head of the European Central Bank, is being tipped to emerge as Greek prime minister, as political leaders bargain over who will lead a new coalition to push through a bailout before the country runs out of money in mid-December. The Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has defied huge pressure to resign, desperately playing his last cards to see off a party revolt as fears over Italy's instability hit markets across Europe. Eurozone governments rushed to placate feverish bond markets today as the 70-nation currency bloc's debt crisis threatened to accelerate out of control. There's little chance that the UN Security Council will impose tough new sanctions on Iran anytime soon, despite a new UN report expected this week to contain evidence suggesting Iran wants atomic weapons. The Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega, a socialist former guerrilla leader, marched towards a landslide re-election victory today after drawing broad support for his anti-poverty programs. Troops and militiamen loyal to the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad moved into a residential district of Homs after 6 days of tank bombardment that killed scores of people and wounded hundreds in the hotbed of unrest, according to residents and activists today. The French Prime Minister François Fillon said today, or announced today, plans for further budget savings of 7 billion euros in 2012 and 11.6 billion euros in 2013 as the Eurozone's second biggest economy seeks to protect its top-notch credit rating and avoid the financial market pressure now engulfing Italy. And finally, news from Thailand. Flood water encircled two industrial estates in the east of Bangkok today and closed in on the centre of the capital, disrupting bus services, although mass transit train systems were still running. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. You are back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bound. Now, Japan is about to send 500 of its troops to South Sudan as part of a UN nation-building mission. The country had to dispatch armed forces in its own borders earlier during this year during the tsunami disaster. Now, 200 Japan ground self-defense force engineers, with 300 to go later, will head to the troubled African region to build roads and bridges in the newly independent capital. There's also oil in Sudan, and some see Japan's move as a predictable one for a country in need of energy supplies after the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster. To get an idea of what's inspired these efforts, we have Dr. Angus Lockyer, historian of modern Japan from the School of Oriental and African Studies here in London, here in the studio. Hi, Angus.
Good evening.
That seemed like quite a long introduction with a lot of facts.
It did. It's a complicated story, but we'll try and get through it.
Well, I'll ask you first. Is it sort of scaremongering to say that Japan might be in South Sudan to have a look at its oil reserves?
No, it's very straightforward. It's a country with no natural resources. It's always been dependent on imports. Before Fukushima, it was trying to raise the amount of nuclear from something like 30 to 50% was the prediction. That's obviously been kind of kiboshed. And so back to the oil fields, I think. It's predictable. It's not the only thing in play here. There's other bits and pieces of the story, but energy security is certainly one of them.
And I wanted to ask you about the idea of a UN nation-building mission. That sounds sounds something like a Bond villain might do, although clearly the boot's on the other foot. But how often does a nation-building mission get sent out, and how often is Japan one of those?
For quite a long time now, I'm not an expert on UN nation building, and nation building in the wake of the last decade has got a slightly dodgy reputation. But no, Japan's been involved really for a long time. I mean, it's been involved in these kinds of missions, or peacekeeping operations, certainly from the late 80s. It got very active in the 90s. And gradually also, as these missions evolve and as nation building efforts evolve, so Japan's commitment has shifted. So we have this idea of the self-defense forces of Japan, which sounds very kind of odd to us all. Why don't they have an army? There are good reasons for that. But the self-defense forces are becoming more involved in these. They're becoming more active. And so it's an interesting moment to see what Japan is doing, both in terms of how it's evolving internally, but also what that means in regard to its relationship to other countries.
Well, let's talk about the idea of the self-defense force. The idea of the self-defense force presumably is a flyback for to the Second World War, but do you find that Japan, or do you see the Japanese as being now frustrated with only having a self-defense force and not a proper military?
It's a very tricky conversation. I mean, it dates back to the Second World War. It dates back to the U.S. Constitution, or the U.S. written Constitution for Japan, which still reads slightly oddly in Japanese, to be honest. But there's an article in that Constitution, famously Article 9, which says, "We shall not go to war." But at the same time, as they were writing the Constitution, or soon after, the US realized that there was a Cold War coming up, and so they encouraged Japan to build up its military forces. The constraint being that these weren't military forces, they were self-defense forces. And of course, for about 50 years, more or less, that was fine. Since 89, since the end of the Cold War, things have shifted, both in the world and in Japan itself. And so there's a very... fierce is too strong, but there's an ongoing debate in Japan as to whether Japan should become more of a normal army. You know, why these restraints when everybody else's armies operate differently? And so I think involvement in these nation-building efforts is part of the redefinition. But there is still, one should say, you know, a huge constituency in Japan which sees Japan as an exceptional country because of its commitment to peace. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be anytime soon, I think, that we'll see Article 9 being written out. But on the other hand, one might do it by stealth, by getting people used to the idea that these guys can do a good job.
And I wonder, in Japan, how this story is sold, how this story, you know, works in the media, how it's sold to the public. Whether it's we're going off to China, it's an adventure and an ambition, or is it very much seen as we are helping out a UN mission. Is that?
I think it's. I think it's definitely the latter. And it's tricky here because also you're dealing with multiple generations within Japan. Obviously, people who grew up in the wake of, in the aftermath of the Second World War have a different relationship to all these issues than younger people. For younger people, you know, it's normal that self-defense forces are getting involved overseas. And also the image of the self-defense forces has been changing a bit. They were, when I started studying Japan about 20 years ago now, they were almost invisible in the public mm-hmm. debate. In the wake of Fukushima in particular, they were one of the few groups who came out with their reputations enhanced. The politicians were feckless. The power company, obviously, is not having a good PR year. But the self-defense forces were there on the ground with boots on in dangerous situations very quickly. And there was great public approval for them, which we've seen in opinion poll numbers. So, yeah, it's shifting. It's shifting.
And obviously the other major Asian player is China, who have been pretty transparent. At least we've reported it in the magazine. It's been, you know, in the international media a lot about their ambitions for mining and for all sorts of things in all parts of Africa. Is this a competition, have China sort of started the way and Japan feel that they're, you know, following their coattails?
Well, Japan was there quite early as well. I mean, mm-hmm. Japan, since the oil crisis in the early 70s, has been reliant on energy imports, and they've diversified the countries from which they import. So they've been there for a while. China in South Sudan, or what was Sudan, which is now South Sudan, has been accelerating. 10 years ago, I think, Japan was importing more. So it's tempting to see it as a competition. I'd like not to. Maybe that's a little too optimistic. But it's clear that for both countries, securing energy supplies, particularly for the Chinese economy, given the way it's growing, is a huge priority. But at the same time, you know, I guess I'm a glass half full kind of guy. I do see countries here, I'm not sure about China's intentions, but certainly in the Japanese case, also, you know, insistent on trying to bring a new country forward, building the infrastructure. So I think that this can be a partnership between how many partners, I'm not sure. But
and I wondered about, is there a Christian element to this? Because the South Sudan is a Christian country. Christianity is a growing religion in Japan. Is there any sort of... you're making a face there.
I'm making a face. I think that would be a push too far. Right?
Yeah, no, I genuinely wondered. I mean, I wonder if there is that idea to it, that it is sort of, again, the Japanese being more of a Western ally than we see China as being, whether there is some sort of, UN-sanctioned idea of building a very friendly African neighbour for the West and for Japan.
A phrase like that, maybe. I mean, I doubt we'll find the smoking gun of a Bible under the minister's bed who made the decision. But, you know, on the other hand, the Japanese commitment to the UN has been longstanding. You know, they were there in the 50s. They joined as a full member in 56. And they're still trying to become a permanent member of the Security Council. So, I think there is a belief in Japan in the principles of the UN, and to the extent that those are premised on, you know, the old Judeo-Christian heritage, maybe there's something there. But I think it's simpler than that. I think it is energy. I think it's the ongoing debate about the SDF. And I think it's also, you know, the UN is a good thing. So let's get involved.
And in terms of the self-defense force, obviously, you know, quite a few of their number are now heading off to Africa. Are they still needed at home, or is it deemed that, you know, this ambition and this helping out is more important than continuing to mop up the Fukushima?
I don't think it's an either or. I think there are still some forces deployed in northeast Japan and will be for some time, I imagine. You know, there's still a cleanup operation there. There's still community building inside the country. But, you know, we're talking simply in terms of the army, the ground self-defense forces. It's 150,000 strong. We're only sending 500. So, you know, it's not an either or zero sum game here.
And is it, do you think it's a dipping, just finally, do you think it's a dipping the toe in the sort of fast running waters of, you know, Africa's oil reserves? Is it a try and see how it goes mission for Japan, or is it, do you think this is the first of a sort of strengthened foray into that continent?
I'd be surprised if it wasn't the latter. I think Fukushima's thrown the whole energy mm-hmm. equation into turmoil. And so it's one of a number of bets that are probably being made in the relevant ministries at this point.
Okay, Angus Locke here. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Midori House here with me, Robert Bound, on M24. We'll be back after this. That was Cherry Radio by Mint Julep here on Monocle 24 with Midori House with Robert Bound. In a moment, we'll be talking to mountaineer Luke Hughes about mountaineering tourism after this.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
You can now download Monocle's first app featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25-25 city guide series. With its unique time shift device to spool through programs, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Welcome back to Midori House, here with me, Robert Bound, in Studio One. Now, earlier today, tourists stranded by bad weather were rescued on Everest, but the hundreds left for 4 days in the foothills of Mount Everest highlights once again the escalating mountain tourism, and that's changing the nature of the sport. To talk us a little through this a little more, we have veteran mountain climber Luke Hughes. Hi, Luke. Welcome to the studio.
Well, thanks very much.
Now, you're a regular, I don't know, I called it a sport. I don't know whether you'd agree with me that. I didn't see you making a face, but I don't know. I suppose mountaineering is a sport, but it's a
Mountaineering is work of international importance.
Okay.
I have to say it has been elevated to that of a sport. The Olympic Authority do now recognise it as a sport. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing, but in sport climbing and rock climbing has become quite an athletic, competitive thing, and that's happened really in the last 15 years.
Now, well, I was going to introduce by saying that you go to the Himalayas every couple of years, and you were last... When were you last up Everest itself?
I was last on Everest in 1988, which was a pretty rough time, but it was quite epic at the time.
I said up Everest, which makes it sound rude. On Everest is clearly the proper verbiage for being on the mountain.
No, I was up Everest.
All right.
I got quite bad frostbite at the time, but that's right. Another story.
Now, obviously things have changed since then, and it seems like obviously the tourismization of mountaineering presumably has sort of changed people's sort of assessment of its risks. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's extremely fair to say. I've got to start by saying that the first big expeditions to Everest started in 1921, when one of the trips on which Mallory went, and he died actually in 1924, I think. But Everest is probably about a centimetre higher, so that's a change, because the Himalayas are pushing up. But more specifically about your point, since 1953, when Hillary and Tenzing and George Band and George Lowe and people like that were on the mountain, it has now become much less of an exploration. Then they didn't know whether they could do it. Now everybody knows they can do it. There must be 3,000 or 4,000 people who've paid to get up Everest. It's a huge number. And I think people are much more cavalier about it. That is a big change.
And I wonder that, because I think, you know, we clearly it's different to this, but I want to make the analogy, and I know that you might kind of, I don't want you to huff about this, but you go skiing once a year, perhaps, and you don't do any training for it, and you think you'll just be able to get through it and eat plenty of fondue and it'll be fine. Is there a sense to that with what is still clearly a very, very dangerous sport that's done at high altitudes with thin oxygen, with lots of kit? I mean, is there a sense that it's become almost like a leisure activity that you can just go off and do with minimal training?
I think it's become a kind of existential consumerism when people think that if they pay the money that they'll be able to get up the mountain. And the answer is they can, because the kit has improved enormously. When the 53 expedition were doing it, they were still mucking around with RAF bottles. In fact, the technology has moved on. The bottles are now made out of titanium. They're much lighter. The flow and the delivery is such that you can get the equivalent number of atmospheres much closer to sea level than it was before, with much less kit to carry. I think the clothing's got a hell of a lot better. The safety gear for anchoring into the mountain has got better and lighter. You always find these Russian aircraft engineers wandering around the Himalayas who've usually nicked all the titanium out of their aircraft place, because they got the lightest kit of all.
Sounds like a church roof in London.
It is a bit like a church roof in London. I think that's exact fair analogy. But I think what has happened is, and I know many mountaineering guides who've had people who've been paying $60,000 to go to thinking they can get up Everest. And as long as the weather's good and they have enough Sherpas and the oxygen's flowing, they will get up Everest. But the trouble is, when things go wrong, and they do go wrong, as we know as from this recent story, then they've got nothing to rely on. There's no instinct. And if mountaineers have been climbing for 30 years or even 15 years, there's an instinctive pattern, a way they clip into a rope, they know about getting their boots on, looking after themselves and so on. But if the idea of you just pay $60,000 and it all happened for you is a bit surreal, and it's particularly problematic. I had a friend who's a guide, who had a guy who'd signed off that he, you know, he was healthy. Anyway, he had a heart attack on the mountain and died. And when they opened him up, they found he had a heart bypass, and they hadn't actually told him. And then he realised when they opened up his shirt.
That's a terrible insurance job. Now, I wanted to ask you about the sort of the reputation of Everest as the tallest and toughest mountain to climb in the world. Is that diminished by the fact that people can pay their $60,000 and go up it? I mean, we said that you go to the Himalayas every 2 years. Presumably, you're doing more exploring now than simply climbing up a mountain you've done before.
I think it is diminished. I think that the route is so well known now, and so you can plot it down to the last minute, more or less, as to where you're going to be on the particular mountain at a particular rate. It's terribly sad because of the thousands of people who go to Nepal every year, most of them go either to Everest National Park or Annapurna Circuit. And when you think how much there is to do out there, and when the people were doing it in the 1950s and earlier, they were going into unknown territory. I'll give you an example. We were in Nepal, in Western Nepal, a couple of years ago, and we went to see the head of mountaineering for the Nepalese government. He told us there were 2,700 mountains that they knew of in Nepal. I say they know of because they didn't know all of them, even with Google Earth. Nobody's counted. 2,700 above 6,000 metres, that's 18,000 feet, and only 270 have actually been climbed. That's a staggering number still to explore, and there are vast valleys still to explore, but nobody bothers going. They all want to go down this same old route.
So they need to be given a reputation of dangerous or high or tortuous, or they need to be everyone needs to be given not just a name or a number, but an adjective as well, presumably, to get people to get the tourism trail going there. Presumably.
Oh, they'll have the first Irish ascent and the first mixed climbing ascent. Everybody's got some kind of ascent going on. And I don't mean to diminish the mountain. It is a very, very big mountain. It's very interesting, though, of the 3,000 or so who've climbed Everest, there are only about 300 who've actually climbed K2, which is a far more serious and dangerous mountain. And I probably not much more than that who've climbed the north face of the Eiger in the Alps, which is a very, really technical and exposed area. But having said all that, there's the Nepalese government and the Chinese government in occupied Tibet have been very keen to promote the possibility of earning money from all of this. And that is a major issue for them all. With it comes rubbish, with it comes tourism, with it comes employment for quite a lot of the local people. But it does diminish the sense of the wilderness. And that is, of course, what most mountaineers who are not paying for it or not professional guides are very keen to preserve.
And how do you, I mean, this is an interesting thing, the business side of it and the sort of branding and tourism side of it. How do you preserve that sense of the wilderness? I mean, China's occupation of Tibet doesn't have a great reputation for, clearing up after itself. Is this part of the problem?
It has got better in part, and people have raised the profile. I'll give you an example. When we were on the mountain in 88, we were on the north side, on the Tibetan side. There was a joint Chinese-Nepalese Japanese expedition. There were 300 people in their expedition, 200 on the north side and 100 on the south side. They'd set up a huge camp. They'd cast a concrete slab on the moraine so they could mount their TV transmitter. They had heaters in their tents, which we thought was a bit very un-British, really. And they'd bust in, they had all the PI. It was unbelievable. It was like a kind of military operation. But the idea that this was mountain exploration, it was too absurd for words. But I have to say, and we were quite a large expedition. We had 25 on our trip at that stage. Most of them were in the military. But now, I mean, most keen mountaineers will go for two or three or four people and disappear into valleys which haven't been explored. It's very stimulating going where nobody's ever been before. You find the pug marks of snow leopards. You find, believe it or not, things that look a bit like Yeti footprints, which you don't know what they are. There's lots of stuff to explore. You can also see, and this is another very exciting part of it, I mean, it's very, very worrying, the direct ascent of glacial recession and what that is doing for those kinds of areas.
Well, it sounds like that's the exploration side of it that we need to be hearing rather than getting people sort of bust off the mountain with a frostbite as well.
Well, frostbite smells a bit. you leave bits behind, but it doesn't hurt.
All right, Luke Hughes, mountaineer and furniture designer, said this. I didn't ask you any questions about that, so I'm sorry about that. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for not allowing your crampons and ice axe to clank too near to the microphone. You're with the Monocle 24. We're back after this. That was Down by Summer Camp, and that's all from us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias, Tom Hall was our researcher, and studio manager was Anna Veal. Nick Kelly is here with the news headlines in just a moment. Then at the top of the hour, it's time for Culture, with me, Robert Bound, again. Then at 2200 hours here in London, it's The Daily with Hugo MacDonald and Emma Nelson. I'm glad we managed to talk Everest and Japan, and here's the news with Nick Kelly.